The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Book 2, Chapter 2, Part 2. First, a man reading the gospel sayings would not find platitudes. If he had read, even in the most respectful spirit, the majority of ancient philosophers and of modern moralists, he would appreciate the unique importance of saying that he did not find platitudes. It is more than can be said even of Plato. It is much more than can be said of Epictetus, or Seneca, or Marcus Aurelius, or Apollonius of Tyana. And it is immeasurably more than can be said of most of the agnostic moralists and the preachers of the ethical societies, with their songs of service and their religion of brotherhood. The morality of most moralists, ancient and modern, has been one solid and polished cataract of platitudes, flowing for ever and ever. That would certainly not be the impression of the imaginary independent outsider studying the New Testament. He would be conscious of nothing so commonplace, and in a sense, of nothing so continuous, as that stream. He would find a number of strange claims that might sound like the claim to be the brother of the sun and moon, a number of very startling pieces of advice, a number of stunning rebukes, a number of strangely beautiful stories. He would see some very gigantesque figures of speech about the impossibility of threading a needle with a camel, or the possibility of throwing a mountain into the sea. He would see a number of very daring simplifications of the difficulties of life, like the advice to shine upon everybody indifferently, as does the sunshine, or not to worry about the future any more than the birds. He would find, on the other hand, some passages of almost impenetrable darkness, so far as he is concerned, such as the moral of the parable of the unjust steward. Some of these things might strike him as fables, and some as truths, but none as truisms. For instance, he would not find the ordinary platitudes in favor of peace. He would find several paradoxes in favor of peace. He would find several ideals of non-resistance, which, taken as they stand, would be rather too pacific for any pacifist. He would be told in one passage to treat a robber not with passive resistance, but rather with positive and enthusiastic encouragement, if the terms be taken literally, heaping up gifts upon the man who had stolen goods. But he would not find a word of all that obvious rhetoric against war which has filled countless books and odes and orations. Not a word about the wickedness of war, the wastefulness of war, the appalling scale of the slaughter in war, and all the rest of the familiar frenzy. Indeed, not a word about war at all. There is nothing that throws any particular light on Christ's attitude towards organized warfare, except that he seems to have been rather fond of Roman soldiers. Indeed, it is another perplexity, speaking from the same external and human standpoint, that he seems to have got on much better with Romans than he did with Jews. But the question here is a certain tone to be appreciated by merely reading a certain text, and we might give any number of instances of it. The statement that the meek shall inherit the earth is very far from being a meek statement. I mean, it is not meek in the ordinary sense of mild and moderate and inoffensive. To justify it, it would be necessary to go very deep into history and anticipate things undreamed of then, and by many unrealized even now. Such is the way in which the mystical monks reclaimed the lands which the practical kings had lost. If it was a truth at all, it was because it was a prophecy, but certainly it was not a truth in the sense of a truism. The blessing upon the meek would seem to be a very violent statement, in the sense of doing violence to reason and probability. And with this we come to another important stage in the speculation. As a prophecy, it really was fulfilled, but it was only fulfilled long afterwards. The monasteries were the most practical and prosperous estates and experiments in reconstruction after the barbaric deluge. The meek did really inherit the earth. But nobody could have known anything of the sort at the time, unless indeed there was one who knew. Something of the same thing may be said about the incident of Martha and Mary, which has been interpreted in retrospect and from the inside by the mystics of the Christian contemplative life. But it was not at all an obvious view of it, and most moralists, ancient and modern, could be trusted to make a rush for the obvious. What torrents of effortless eloquence would have flowed from them to swell any slight superiority on the part of Martha? What splendid sermons about the joy of service, and the gospel of work, and the world left better than we found it, and generally all the 10,000 platitudes that can be uttered in favor of taking trouble by people who need take no trouble to utter them. If in Mary, the mystic and child of love, Christ was guarding the seed of something more subtle, who was likely to understand it at the time? Nobody else could have seen Claire and Catherine and Teresa shining above the little roof at Bethany. It is so in another way, with that magnificent menace about bringing into the world a sword to sunder and divide. Nobody could have guessed then either how it could be fulfilled or how it could be justified. Indeed, some freethinkers are still so simple as to fall into the trap and be shocked at a phrase so deliberately defiant. They actually complain of the paradox not being a platitude. But the point here is that if we could read the gospel reports as things as new as newspaper reports, they would puzzle us and perhaps terrify us much more than the same things as developed by historical Christianity. For instance, Christ, after a clear allusion to the eunuchs of Eastern courts, said there would be eunuchs of the kingdom of heaven. If this does not mean the voluntary enthusiasm of virginity, it could only be made to mean something much more unnatural or uncouth. It is the historical religion that humanizes it for us by experience of Franciscans or of Sisters of Mercy. The mere statement standing by itself might very well suggest a rather dehumanized atmosphere. The sinister and inhuman silence of the Asiatic harem and divan. This is but one instance out of scores. But the moral is that the Christ of the gospel might actually seem more strange and terrible than the Christ of the church. I am dwelling on the dark, or dazzling, or defiant, or mysterious side of the gospel words, not because they had not obviously a more obvious and popular side, but because this is the answer to a common criticism on a vital point. The freethinker frequently says that Jesus of Nazareth was a man of his time, even if he was in advance of his time, and that we cannot accept his ethics as final for humanity. The freethinker then goes on to criticize his ethics, saying plausibly enough that man cannot turn the other cheek, or that they must take thought for the morrow, or that the self-denial is too ascetic, or the monogamy too severe. But the zealots and the legionaries did not turn the other cheek any more than we do, if so much. The Jewish traders and Roman tax-gatherers took thought for the morrow as much as we, if not more. We cannot pretend to be abandoning the morality of the past for one more suited to the present. It is certainly not the morality of another age, but it might be of another world. In short, we can say that these ideals are impossible in themselves. Exactly what we cannot say is that they are impossible for us. They are rather notably marked by a mysticism which, if it be a sort of madness, would always have struck the same sort of people as mad. Take, for instance, the case of marriage and the relations of the sexes. It might very well have been true that a Galilean teacher taught things natural to a Galilean environment. But it is not. It might rationally be expected that a man in the time of Tiberius would have advanced a view conditioned by the time of Tiberius. But he did not. What he advanced was something quite different, something very difficult, but something no more difficult now than it was then. When, for instance, Muhammad made his polygamous compromise, we may reasonably say that it was conditioned by a polygamous society. When he allowed a man four wives, he was really doing something suited to the circumstances, which might have been less suited to other circumstances. Nobody will pretend that the four wives were like the four winds, something seemingly a part of the order of nature. Nobody will say that the figure four was written forever in stars upon the sky. But neither will anyone say that the figure four is an inconceivable ideal, that it is beyond the power of the mind of man to count up to four, or to count the number of his wives and see whether it amounts to four. It is a practical compromise, carrying with it the character of a particular society. If Muhammad had been born in Acton in the 19th century, we may well doubt whether he would instantly have filled that suburb with harems of four wives apiece. As he was born in Arabia in the 6th century, he did in his conjugal arrangements suggest the conditions of Arabia in the 6th century. But Christ, in his view of marriage, does not in the least suggest the conditions of Palestine of the 1st century. He does not suggest anything at all, except the sacramental view of nature of marriage as developed long afterwards by the Catholic Church. It was quite as difficult for people then as for people now. It was much more puzzling to people then than to people now. Jews and Romans and Greeks did not believe, and did not even understand enough to disbelieve, the mystical idea that the man and the woman had become one sacramental substance. We may think it an incredible or an impossible ideal, but we cannot think it any more incredible or impossible than they would have thought it. In other words, whatever else is true, it is not true that the controversy has been altered by time. Whatever else is true, it is emphatically not true that the ideas of Jesus of Nazareth were suitable to his time, but are no longer suitable to our time. Exactly how suitable they were to his time is perhaps suggested in the end of his story. The same truth might be stated in another way, by saying that if the story be regarded as merely human and historical, it is extraordinary how very little there is in the recorded words of Christ that ties him at all to his own time. I do not mean the details of a period, which even a man of the period knows to be passing. I mean the fundamentals, which even the wisest man often vaguely assumes to be eternal. For instance, Aristotle was perhaps the wisest and most wide-minded man who ever lived. He founded himself entirely upon fundamentals, which have been generally found to remain rational and solid through all social and historical changes. Still, He lived in a world in which it was thought to be as natural to have slaves as to have children. And therefore he did permit himself a serious recognition of a difference between slaves and free men. Christ, as much as Aristotle, lived in a world that took slavery for granted. He did not particularly denounce slavery. He started a movement which could exist in a world with slavery. But he started a movement that could exist in a world without slavery. He never used a phrase that made his philosophy depend even upon the very existence of the social order in which he lived. He spoke as one conscious that everything was ephemeral, including the things that Aristotle thought eternal. By that time, the Roman Empire had come to be merely the Orbis Terrarum, another name for the world. But he never made his morality dependent upon the existence of the Roman Empire, or even on the existence of the world. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. The truth is that when critics have spoken of the local limitations of the Galilean, it has always been a case of the local limitations of the critics. He did undoubtedly believe in certain things that one particular modern sect of materialists do not believe. But they were not things particularly peculiar to his time. It would be nearer the truth to say that the denial of them is quite peculiar to our time. Doubtless it would be nearer still to the truth to say merely that a certain solemn social importance, in the minority disbelieving them, is peculiar to our time. He believed, for instance, in evil spirits or in the psychic healing of bodily ills, but not because he was a Galilean born under Augustus. It is absurd to say that a man believed things because he was a Galilean under Augustus, when he might have believed the same things if he had been an Egyptian under Tutankhamun, or an Indian under Genghis Khan. But with this general question of the philosophy of diabolism or of divine miracles, I deal elsewhere. It is enough to say that the materialists have to prove the impossibility of miracles against the testimony of all mankind, not against the prejudices of provincials in North Palestine under the first Roman emperors. What they have to prove, for the present argument, is the presence in the Gospels of those particular prejudices of those particular provincials. And humanly speaking, it is astonishing how little they can produce even to make a beginning of proving it. So it is in this case of the sacrament of marriage. We may not believe in sacraments as we may not believe in spirits, but it is quite clear that Christ believed in this sacrament in his own way, and not in any current or contemporary way. He certainly did not get his argument against divorce from the Mosaic law, or the Roman law, or the habits of the Palestinian people. It would appear to his critics then exactly what it appears to his critics now, an arbitrary and transcendental dogma coming from nowhere, save in the sense that it came from him. I am not at all concerned here to defend that dogma. The point here is that it is just as easy to defend it now as it was to defend it then. It is an ideal altogether outside time, difficult at any period, impossible at no period. In other words, if anyone says it is what might be expected of a man walking about in that place at that period, we can quite fairly answer that it is much more like what might be the mysterious utterance of a being beyond man, if he walked alive among men. I maintain, therefore, that a man reading the New Testament frankly and freshly would not get the impression of what is now often meant by a human Christ. The merely human Christ is a made-up figure, a piece of artificial selection, like the merely evolutionary man. Moreover, there have been too many of these human Christs found in the same story, just as there have been too many keys to mythology found in the same stories. Three or four separate schools of rationalism have worked over the ground and produced three or four equally rational explanations of his life. The first rational explanation of his life was that he never lived. And this in turn gave an opportunity for three or four different explanations, as that he was a sun myth, or a corn myth, or any other kind of myth that is also a monomania. Then the idea that he was a divine being who did not exist gave place to the idea that he was a human being who did exist. In my youth, it was the fashion to say that he was merely an ethical teacher in the manner of the Essenes, who had apparently nothing very much to say that Hillel or 100 other Jews might not have said, as that it is a kindly thing to be kind, and an assistance to purification to be pure. Then somebody said he was a madman with a messianic delusion. Then others said he was indeed an original teacher, because he cared about nothing but socialism, or, as others said, about nothing but pacifism. Then a more grimly scientific character appeared, who said that Jesus would never have been heard of at all except for his prophecies of the end of the world. He was important merely as a millenarian like Dr. Cumming, and created a provincial scare by announcing the exact date of the crack of doom. Among other variants on the same theme was the theory that he was a spiritual healer and nothing else, a view implied by Christian Science, which has really to expound a Christianity without the crucifixion, in order to explain the curing of Peter's wife's mother, or the daughter of the centurion. There is another theory that concentrates entirely on the business of diabolism, and what it would call the contemporary superstition about demoniacs. As if Christ, like a young deacon taking his first orders, had got as far as exorcism and never got any further. Now, each of these explanations in itself seems to me singularly inadequate, but taken together they do suggest something of the very mystery which they miss. There must surely have been something not only mysterious but many-sided about Christ, if so many smaller Christs can be carved out of him. If the Christian Scientist is satisfied with him as a spiritual healer, and the Christian Socialist is satisfied with him as a social reformer, so satisfied that they do not even expect him to be anything else, it looks as if he really covered rather more ground than they could be expected to expect. And it does seem to suggest that there might be more than they fancy in these other mysterious attributes of casting out devils or prophesying doom. Above all, would not such a new reader of the New Testament stumble over something that would startle him much more than it startles us? I have here more than once attempted the rather impossible task of reversing time and the historic method, and in fancy looking forward to the facts instead of backward through the memories. So I have imagined the monster that man might have seemed at first to the mere nature around him. We should have a worse shock if we really imagined the nature of Christ named for the first time. What should we feel at the first whisper of a certain suggestion about a certain man? Certainly it is not for us to blame anybody who should find that first wild whisper merely impious and insane. On the contrary, stumbling on that rock of scandal is the first step. Stark, staring incredulity is a far more loyal tribute to that truth than a modern metaphysic that would make it out merely a matter of degree. It were better to rend our robes with a great cry against blasphemy, like Caiaphas in the judgment, or to lay hold of the man as a maniac possessed of devils, like the kinsman in the crowd, rather than to stand stupidly debating fine shades of pantheism in the presence of so catastrophic a claim. There is more of the wisdom that is won with surprise in any simple person, full of the sensitiveness of simplicity, who should expect the grass to wither and the birds to drop dead out of the air, when a strolling carpenter's apprentice said calmly and almost carelessly, like one looking over his shoulder, "Before Abraham was, I am." End of chapter 2 of book 2.